It's a lack of trust in learners that we see reflected in the I must check every single piece of work, it must pass through me kind of mentality, and I must score everything.
Then we're actually looking at space as a symbol for learning versus just a capture tool for humans to wait out a certain period of time.
What does flexible or agile, as she said, learning spaces, what do they look like when we consider where we are in the world?
When we talk about place-based learning, it's really how communities come together to solve problems.
Hello and welcome to the Coconut Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Benjamin Freud, and today's guests are Jennifer D. Klein and Jill Akers Clayton. Jennifer has a broad background in global education and global partnership development, student-centered curricular strategies, diversity and inclusivity work, authentic assessment, and experiential inquiry-driven learning. She has written several books, including The Global Education Guidebook, Humanizing K-12 Classrooms Worldwide Through Equitable Partnerships, and The Landscape Model of Learning, Designing Student-Centered Experiences for Cognitive and Cultural Inclusion. And she has been accepted recently for a third book. Jill is an influential educator with nearly three decades of experience across a broad spectrum of the educational sector. Her publication, Developing Natural Curiosity Through Project-Based Learning, Five Strategies for the Pre-K to 3 Classroom, highlights her dedication to innovative education, and she's currently the Director of Education at VS America. The role involves collaborating with architectural firms, interior designers, and furniture vendors globally to create adaptable, flexible, and dynamic learning spaces. And this conversation takes us in many directions. We actually are talking about, or the title is Rewilding. There's also this idea of spaces, the physical space, the space in between us, the space inside us, the space that we create when we come together as learners. There's also this thread about gathering, which is much more the collaboration, and Jill will investigate this and explore this in the conversation. I'm quite excited to share these two wonderful women and thinkers. And check out our website, www.coconut-thinking.com. Again, it's www.coconut-thinking.com. And I will leave space for my conversation with Jennifer and Jill. Well, I'm so excited to have Jill and Jennifer here on the show. Jen, you've been on the show before. Jill, this is a great way for us to get to know one another. And you've already kind of mentioned in the part before the recording some of the work that you're doing. I'm just going to open it up straight and just get right into it. What brings you two together and where are you going?
That's a great question. Jennifer and I got together years ago through an experience that we both were involved in project-based learning, but we're also both deeply involved in, I think, human-centered design and the aspect of non-traditional methods for how learning and human behavior comes together. And I think over the last, I believe it's been longer than 10 years, but maybe not. And over the last 10 years, really thinking about generational sustainability through learning environments. And that necessarily doesn't mean your physical environment, but the environment in which people grow. And I think we're both really passionate about that.
Yeah, I can jump in that as well and say, you know, one of the fundamental ideas at the core of the landscape model of learning, but also my work in general, is this idea of how we include all students in one way or another, how we make sure that every single child feels seen, feels honored, feels recognized for the talents that they bring into the space, for the identities that they bring in to the learning environment, and what it looks like to really cultivate an environment, whether we're talking about the learning space in physical form or the culture of the school or classroom, how we do or don't invite all students to grow and shine and feel supported in who they are. along the way. So got really excited with Jill. She points out we've been doing work together for a really long time. I used to wrangle trips for her and her daughters down to the school that I led in Bogota to help my teachers move forward, because she was one of those people who could really help teachers change their practice, and leaders as well. And in the last couple of years, the intersections between the inclusion and equity work and what we would describe as spatial design or learning space design has become more and more apparent to both of us. So we bring a lot of passion to both, to all sides of this. But I think in the end, what we're looking for is, what does it look like to develop a space that really cultivates well-being and growth for every single child?
And I love this idea that the space is physical as well as non-physical and going beyond the physical. And I'm also so curious about going into this idea of bringing in the strengths coming from a culture of abundance. Before we get there, what's the landscape model of learning?
So the landscape model of learning is a book that I co-authored with Kapono Siati, and you and I actually did a podcast on this. So folks can learn more about that book if they're interested there. The idea of the landscape model in simple form is to try to shift our mindsets in education away from a racetrack model where we think we have all the students lined up at the same starting line. We think we're getting them all to the same finish line, except we know as educators that's not actually what happens. And we get lots of kids who get stuck along the way and who feel stuck for weeks, months, years of their education and feel really obviously stuck, while others, you know, are not being challenged appropriately. So the shift toward the landscape is a recognition that every student starts where they start in their learning, that their growth is about their moving from where they are to where they want to be, and a recognition that we don't necessarily have to be educating all students in exactly the same way, and that, in fact, we should be developing those more personal systems that allow students to find multiple pathways toward the horizons that make sense to them. So it's very much a shift in metaphor, not necessarily brand new practice in education. I think we were digging into, you know, the history of experiential and student-centered learning to basically just shift that mindset and recognize. There's a great quotation early in the book about, you know, when a flower doesn't grow, we need to change the environment in which it grows, not the flower. and that's, I think, in essence, what the book is about, is changing that mindset so that we are really cultivating the growth of every child.
One of the questions I have about strength is this notion that in order to identify strength, in order to recognize the strength, we have to put the systems in, we have to put the culture and the relationships in to identify that. And in posthumanist terms, and anyways, like this question of measurement there, and I don't mean measurement necessarily quantitatively, but we have to do something in order to say this person is strong in this way. In a system where there's so few opportunities to go beyond the traditional measures, how can we start to identify strengths and cultivate them so that we're able to quickly identify them and certainly let them grow?
That's a great question. Yeah, I want to take it on and share it and unpack it and even ask questions for where you're coming from in the sense of how do we identify strengths in students and then also those strengths in the systems in which we're designing, which then cultivate those strengths in students. And I think from looking at the physical environment as a feedback source, space is a sense of feedback. And I think how humans use and settle into space, really coming from that perspective, allows us to draw on strengths that students intuitively have or need to build their own strengths. And so how do we use the physical environment as a catalyst to identify and measure what students need and what their personal ability is to become aware of their own strengths, and how we build that kind of systemic understanding through that anecdotal observation of how students manifest strengths within space allows us to start to move towards greater meaning in the systems for students to individually represent who they are and how they grow. So going back to the landscape model is the metaphor piece. How do we look at the way we design spaces as a metaphor to begin evaluating the strengths of facilities that are actually designed for, in a sense, infancy to elderism. So that way we're looking at community as a source of strength, not just a place where we enter in model strength in such a quick way that it doesn't actually think, look at reflection as a renewal process. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's in the sense how I see facility building out strengths.
I think there's a lot there too that ties into my thinking about what it looks like for students to become increasingly empowered to recognize their own strengths. You know, we've built systems of assessment around this idea that the adult is the one who decides what the growth has been. And I've never quite understood that. I mean, I think, you know, having grown up in systems that were very different, that were much more student-centered myself, it's been always been very clear to me that the adult is a support who helped me figure out whether I was right about what I thought was happening in myself, who was there to be a feedback, to provide that feedback loop, to help me notice things that perhaps my ego didn't allow me to notice about where I still needed to grow. But I think that in the end, you know, and space can help to cultivate this, right? So a space where the adult is the dominant power figure in the room and does all of the assessment or all of the measuring of growth is not a space that I would want my own grandkids in. I would like to imagine an education that is much more about functioning on equal footing, where we're all discussing our growth all the time and we're always reflecting, as Jill described, so that it's not just in the hands of the adult to make the decisions about what goes in the gradebook. And we might need to let go of the gradebook too to get there, but that might be another conversation.
or one that we can have very, very soon, because where we're looking at here is also, and I'm looking at it because some of these might look like they're granular pieces, but they're entry points into the larger systemic problems of the grades, of the fact that we are in systems where you have to be able to read it quickly, you have to be able to move forward, and the narrative pieces that a lot of schools have are really problematic. I also want to pick up on something that you said, Jill. You brought up the word observation or anecdotal observation. Now, that to me, the first thing I thought when you said spaces, and I know I'm going on two different paths here, but I think they'll come together in the end. When you talk about those spaces and anecdotal observations, I'm thinking about the early years model, where there's all these different places and all these natural materials and inside, outside, and then the educator or the adult in a room starts to take notes and does those. But somehow we let go of that. We let go of those anecdotal observations, and then we go towards these grades. I'm not asking the question, where did it all go wrong? But I'm trying to think about how do we reconcile this idea of trusting the anecdote, trusting the observation, trusting the feeling that we have, and then telling the story beyond the grades. It's a big question, but there's many different threads. Maybe we can pull on one of them. That's interesting.
I mean, my heartstrings really go back to, you know, anecdotal observations and trust. I think that I'll always go back to Stephen Covey's book, The Speed of Trust, and that you can't have trust without the balance of competence and character. And when we educate kids, we take out the character, we focus solely on competence, but that's where we lose that trust and we stop building that balance. And so when we look at and study cultures and the way that different communities design spaces, it's around anecdotal observation of problem solving and narrative and storytelling. And we've worked out those pieces as we've graded our classrooms. And so those basic design elements within a facility should really respond to how we observe the inquiry and that problem solving process, because that's how we as teachers use storytelling and narrative and history and science and math as the story to help that process. And if we can't observe how students gather, I am a huge proponent of not using the word collaborate. I'm a huge proponent of the word gathering, because our job as educators is to truly create venues where kids come together, they gather to make meaning. And so within that gathering, I have to be an expert ethnographer, and I have to be able to spin and understand how all those groups are moving through something to not only architect, in a sense, the experience, design, be the architect to help kids either sink deeply in something or say, oh, let's add this narrative in to build out that contextual piece. So that anecdotal observation is actually so intricately tied to how humans gather to understand and see how the body itself manifests or represents learning successfully or not. And I think I grew up within somewhat of a crazy childhood, but I had to observe the adults in my life consistently and many times on a survival level, not just like these were observations of, can I eat today or do I need to find somewhere else to sleep so I can have food for the day? But part of that learning process for me, which isn't school learning, it's human learning, is how you read body language. And I think that we lose the excitement for the human in the learning process when we stick so tightly to that graded assessment piece. And we've lost that from early childhood because we're now so focused on the content. How do we start to utilize physical spaces so that teachers can understand gathering is about true observation of body language for learning, of body language for where the different types of personas, and this is the work that I'm doing with David Stubbs, where the different personas and proxemics come into play to represent successfulness in understanding or simply feeling safe in an environment. And without understanding those kind of cues or creating the environment where those cues are available and suitable, and in a sense, even culturally acceptable, because if I don't understand your culture, I'm not going to be able to understand your body language, which might be representing safety or feeling unsafe. And so that to me symbolizes that understanding of anecdotal observation, because as teachers, whether you're in a traditional 50-minute cycle, it's all about how humans gather within those spaces. So anecdotal observations are extremely important, and not where we went wrong, but how do we start to bring that back in, and space being a catalyst for that kind of change management scenario that's really focused on adaptable shifts based on human habits, human daily habits, and shifting that priority.
I want to jump onto it too, if I can, Benjamin, and say, I think that question, that central word, trust, is the core to why we have the adults making all of the decisions about assessment as well, right? It's a lack of trust in learners that we see reflected in the I must check every single piece of work, it must pass through me kind of mentality, and I must score everything. And I think Jill is really right to say we've lost a little bit of the human piece to all of this. These are children, these are young people. Even at 18, they're still in their formation, right? And so our job is far less to judge them and far more to trust that they as learners can get to where they need to be based on their desires, their aspirations, who they are, their strengths, and their areas for growth, right? So I think when it comes down to it, I'm fascinated by this idea, honestly, of how the space itself can engender that trust or create that trust. And the teacher who is desperate to hold on, and I say this with all due respect, of course, the teacher who is desperate to hold on to that power will be overwhelmed instantly by a more flexible space, right? And by the chaos, which I see as when it's at its best, as you know, the buzz of constructive chaos, which is a really good thing, but is scary for the teacher who wants to feel like they have control over the group, you know? So I think there are some really interesting things that shift, especially as we move out of early education and into the upper years, that may have more to do with compliance and thinking that compliance looks a lot like engagement when it's not really engagement, and really trusting our learners. If we are not controlling every step, we might actually get more from them. we get might get more motivation, more excitement, more who they are in the things that they do. We might get things that are more uniquely theirs, if that makes sense, if we don't hold those reins so tightly. But I think that trust is at the core of that question as well.
So let's talk about flexible spaces. So if we think about your typical classroom, it tends to be in a box. In the 70s, there was this whole movement about having open spaces. Now this idea of flexible space, what might that look like? And how does that cultivate trust?
Sure. I mean, I think that there's still the double-loaded corridor model, the kind of cells and bells model, working with Prakash Nair and Randy Fielding for many years and really unpacking that in spaces. And that design of schools really do feel like that pipeline for many kids. And so when we think about flexible spaces and learning environments, there are multiple opportunities being designed right now that are learning community models. So where teachers in any don't own any one particular space, they have a kit of parts or a suite of spaces that they can then work with and schedule. So I might not need to see and do my and work with my students in direct instruction or explicit instruction, whatever. I know that they're different. So in whatever way you're working with them, you might schedule different spaces for where you need to be. And so building trust out in those spaces, we call them learning commons area, global learning commons. In family, in spaces where we've really looked at culture, it might be considered a family room where learning actually starts in those commons areas. Typically, they're termed as breakout spaces or secondary spaces, but we're really looking at agile learning as every area is a primary space. So we're breaking apart master schedules and thinking about what are the ways in which kids need to work with content and make meaning with their peers in that social aspect. What are the spaces that need to emerge so we can set up kids for success? Now, not every building is designed in that learning community model. There are still many spaces that are built off that classroom model. And so when we talk about agile spaces or flexibility, it means that that venue can be reconfigured quickly to adjust for when I need to meet with a whole group, when I need students to pair off, when there needs to be individual reflection, when I have small group instruction. The best designers that I've worked with typically provide three levels of height. Some students like to work low to the ground. They like to be able to see. So when you have everything at one height, you lose a lot of visibility and sightline. So working at multiple heights, dimensionality in those pieces, we know that when kids are put into smaller gathering groups of three or four, most often they typically prefer working by a window, because they can find that they can sit underneath the window or close to it, and it has an openness as though they're separated. So the light really plays a big role. Whether or not kids can get underneath something creates that flexibility. So when we're looking at teachers and their instructional design, we know that the goal is to elicit higher quality thinking throughout the flow of whatever experience they've created. And so that movement symbolizes that flow or that cycle of learning as well. And so if we can start to think about flexible spaces, not as furniture on wheels, or furniture that provides, three or four different shapes, but really as an agile or flexible space that helps that flow during the learning process and creates a toolbox, not only for teachers and students, then we're actually looking at space as a symbol for learning versus just a capture tool for humans to wait out a certain period of time.
Love this. And I want to pull this also, Benjamin, if I can, in the direction of culture, because one of the things that Jill and I are working on currently is this question of what does flexible or agile, as she said, learning spaces, what do they look like when we consider where we are in the world, and really bring in that place-based element to our thinking about the learning environment. So we've got the double-loaded corridors, which is a very Western sort of construct, right? But in schools like the one that you're working in, there's a recognition that's not what learning spaces necessarily should look like in a given community, right? That we want the learning environment to somehow reflect who students really are, who the users, if you will, of this space really are, and to allow space to reflect that culture somehow, or to have enough flexibility and agility to allow the shifts to in who these users are. And I'm putting that in quotation marks here on the video, which of course nobody will see in the podcast. But when I say users, of course, I'm using a term that comes more from design thinking and from the business world, but students are our users, right? Just as, I mean, they are the end users who we're designing for. So what does it look like to think in a non-Western way, to allow that the building itself and the learning spaces themselves reflect who is in the room, and the culture and the values? And we've been playing with this word ethos, which is such a wonderfully multidimensional word in so many different languages, right? So that idea of ethos as being about values and character and climate and mood and the feeling of a place. Wouldn't we want our learning environments to capture that in a meaningful and positive way, so that learners feel not only affirmed as individuals, but also can kind of see their own culture and lives reflected in those spaces, as opposed to the space that the teacher dominates and designs and decorates entirely, that is devoid of the character of the community that they're serving in?
Right. And I think in the architectural community, that's called attemptive planning. We take our own perspectives and we attempt to plan physical spaces based on what we understand school to be, and that we're not truly representing community engaged planning that typically, and I'll go back to the word that infancy to elderism, because when we talk about place-based learning, it's really how communities come together to solve problems. And by cooperating and understanding together that narrative and storytelling. And I think that goes back to a deep understanding of dialogic practices. And so we are not, I think, as teachers, really deeply seated, or we don't spend enough time in understanding true dialogic practices to understand where the learner is within that space and place, and how to break those apart shifts the mechanisms for teacher training to just mastery of content, but how to engage in dialogue that shows that depth or critical thinking beyond just that information gathering. And I think that space can be, again, a catalyst for how we see storytelling, and looking at the storytelling of cultures and indigenous people, and designing space around how they look at community really changes a teacher's ability to understand dialogic practices.
So now we have three words. We've got space, physical, space, the culture, and then place. And this idea of place-based, which is certainly something that's, maybe it's, you know, in our echo chamber, we hear about it a lot more and so forth. And I get that, but there's still such a concept there that actually some of us might not hear it, but it's there. There's a place, there's that community, which is unique. I do resist that problem solution idea, unless it is place-based, because there's a uniqueness to place, whereas the problem doesn't get replicated elsewhere. So how do we connect with this idea of community and appreciating what goes beyond the school and connecting with some of the folks that are around, like you mentioned, intergenerational? What might that look like beyond the school building, beyond that space of the school building in a culture and in physical form, to connect with the place that we're in, which is our community? How might that take us in new directions for learning and education?
I'd love to jump in on that first, and then I know Jill will have a whole bunch to add to it. So my first book was actually focused on global education and the building of global partnerships. And I was concerned by something that I think you're hinting at, Benjamin, which is this feeling that so often, if we are solving problems beyond our own community, we're actually just reenacting colonialism, right? We're really just suggesting that one culture or place has the answers to how to fix others, which I think is a really, really dangerous road to go down. So I agree with you, first of all, that 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 we want to stay more focused on the challenges within our own communities and within our own environments. I think that the global partner, just to say, you know, quickly, I think the global partner is really valuable for potential feedback, for offering us different ways of thinking about how we might solve a given challenge, for collaborating and partnering and offering all sorts of different insights that we might not have thought of within our insular community. But I think that what you're hinting at, that much more deeply rooted place-based learning where we can partner with local community businesses and organizations and individuals who are working on either experiencing the problem that we are trying to solve or working on solutions already for that challenge. I think that, you know, anything that we can do to remove the walls of the classroom, if you will, right, going back to space, I think is going to be really valuable. I grew up in experiential schools. And our motto the whole way through was our classrooms have no walls, right? And so I grew up with that feeling that even though, yes, I was in a building that did have walls because I was in Colorado and we have winter here, that those walls were not a boundary for the learning, right? That we could go off of campus all the time in any way we wanted, bring people in, make those connections long before the virtual world made it easier to do, because that was valuable to learning. But Jill, why don't you jump in too then on those community partnerships and that deeper sense of place?
Oh, there's so much to unpack there. I think about it from so many different levels. And I think the work that we're focused on and sort of moving beyond just the Euro-Western facilities and building design and how to actually use the landscape as connection to place for solving problems. It's also unpacking what does that community connection look like in the sense of what are the porches in the neighborhoods look like? What are the natural building materials? What are the plazas? What are the ramadas? What are the building types and materials? And how are we actually bringing those into the environment versus teachers decorating each of their own spaces like their own home? And so how do we start to create connections groups through visioning, through community engagement? So we're building in the characteristics of true culture and place-based experiences, even how and where we place doors via the east for the morning class, how we're using shading as an opportunity for gathering. What are the longstanding traditions and materials that communities use that they brought into modern living? Even signage in in the non-Euro-Western experience is very different. And I think working globally around the world has given me such an appreciation for that, in that how we actually bring the ethos of a community to be part of that modern living experience allows us to change the shape and the destination of what learning should look like, feel like, and sound like, to go back to that kind of teacher language. But we have to get an understanding of what it means to walk through a learning experience based on that place so that we're not always looking outside, but we're actually looking inside for that cultural piece. I don't know if that makes sense. Not that you don't get it, but that I'm not being clear. I think there's so much I want to get out because so involved, we often solve when we're designing buildings or even selecting furniture just based on our own experience, and spending time in connections groups allows us to create the visioning opportunities that are relevant to those local spaces or local communities or indigenous populations that I think get left out of building design. And some of the most beautiful buildings that I've been in recently, you know, considered the best, some of the best school buildings in the world. And they're really missing the connection to those local community and traditions because someone's taking their, for lack of a better word, their ego and putting their ego into a building versus truly understanding when students gather within a space, what needs to happen and how should that space continuously be a flexible space. So it's not designed for learning to feel like one model, which is how we've done this sort of Euro-Western style group, is this one model of space and creating that kind of flexibility within that. That even means changing the dining experience. I'm working in San Francisco Unified Public Schools right now and with their director of innovation for dining. And the entire district is looking at how do we reimagine dining as an opportunity to really elevate the culture of our students in the entire district. So they're literally spending a couple of years reimagining dining, and we're looking at connections group, food production. How do we utilize food that we can actually cultivate within our own spaces? I was just on Big Spring Reservation, a Seminole community in Florida, and their food production program is truly indigenous to their tribe. And yet we go into their building and the doors don't face east. The tribal markings are decoration. They're actually not built into the space because they had a very Western architect. And a part of my heart was breaking a little bit because you could feel the culture in the room pushing back on a brand new building already because it wasn't designed around the characteristics of the humans that actually use the space. And when we walked out into the traditional spaces with students, they lit up, they started talking. It wasn't an authoritarian coming in to observe. It was, you're now in my culture. I'm a storyteller here. And let me tell you the story of how these plants nourish our life. And I felt really honored to see the awakening of these students from one experience to another within the physical environment. But I felt really sad that we didn't honor that in the learning environment itself. They were two totally separate pieces. And you could see a change in human behavior between the two because traditions and safety based on what their culture was put into and thought of so highly. And I think that we lose a lot of opportunity when we don't spend time looking at how porches and roofs and plazas are designed to awaken that connection.
And of course, this takes us, again, it's all enmeshed and entangled in terms of the physicality of it, but also the learning experiences that we can do so that the learning experiences also cannot be replicated. They must be based in community, response to community. And I'm going to involve the more than the human world here too, some of the local, ecological, environmental, whatever that might mean, issues there. How might we start to resist this, the overarching narrative, the overarching curriculum, resist that in order to bring in and infuse more of the local community in these experiences when at the same time, so many teachers are accountable to state standards. Texas is a big state. California is a big state. And there's so many different ecosystems, local areas. How do we play with that tension, the reality on the ground?
That's a great question. And I think schools are starting to figure that out in a variety of ways. I certainly don't want this to be the final answer to your question, but I know of one school here in the local Denver area that has chosen specifically to be a micro independent school, right? And a micro school specifically so that they can figure out how to push those boundaries, right? Without all of the restrictions in place that come with being a public school. I am continually, and this is something Capono and I have nearly wept over, is how consistently we see wonderful, exciting, incredible things happening in after school programs more than in the school day for the very same reason. And we talked about Reschool Colorado in the landscape model as an example of that, an organization that was trying desperately to change the system itself and found that it was almost impossible to do so. And so they started building out enrichment programs outside of the school day because it was the best way that they could create change. But that changing the system, I don't want that to be the final answer, of course, because it's really depressing to think that we couldn't change the system itself. Jill, you might have more experience than I do with schools that are within public education that are figuring out how to push those boundaries.
Well, I think when we talk about teacher learning and changing contexts, we have to rewild teachers. I don't find, and I wasn't one of those that grew up naturally with a connection to the outdoors. I didn't learn it until I was in my early 20s teaching. My very first job was teaching at an Outward Bound style school where we had to be in the, I had to teach algebra and pre-algebra in the community and do true place-based learning and solve problems and challenges. But that was a rewilding experience for me and how to actually make those connections. And I think if we want to look and deepen this practice, there are a lot of prongs here for what it means to rewild folks. If you look on LinkedIn, that's actually a job to rewild people. And I've really become fascinated with that. They actually make more than I do. So I'm kind of, part of me is like, oh, maybe I should go look for a whole new career. But in the sense of we have to start taking these connection groups and whether you call it job embedded professional development, but we have to create the connections beyond the school. It's really hard for me as an educator to start to teach in a changing context when I have no prior experience of my own. And doing the same thing in, with architects and interior designers and starting to rewild them and really look at those cultures that build out and start to reimagine what those traditions are for learning. And I think that that we have to do at a facilities and budgeting level. We have to do that at a bonding level when we're looking at going out to bond in large public school districts is how do we build in this opportunity through facilities design to start to think about the buildings in a different way. And that means spending time with a lot of architects to really rewild them and understand that school doesn't look like this and project-based learning doesn't have a room. If you have a deep, true understanding of project-based learning, it doesn't matter where you are. And so your space has to really be about gathering of people and spreading apart and coming together. And so I think educating architects and designers and facility managers really helps us change that learning context. And when we start to bring teachers alongside and let them see how the building and furniture and that FF&E piece helps them facilitate more of what they want to do. Because if when we start to unpack and analyze the content and the state standards, it calls for gathering. It calls for that collection of human beings to work together, yet our buildings push back on us. Our chairs, the selections. But what happens is we get people in procurement who they're just putting forward an order without understanding how the building is a catalyst for teaching and learning. When we can start to bring those pieces together, I think we're going to find a big shift, but that's going to take that time to start to get that. All of those people talking, but I think we can find the funding and the resources for rewilding through our facilities departments and master planning opportunities, whether you're an independent school. We've done this, I've done this in Singapore American School, NIST in Thailand, Kleji Montserrat in Barcelona, when we look at NIDO in South America and Chile. How we utilize our facility can be a huge catalyst for reimagining how teaching and learning can impact all users or humans within an environment. We see a huge wellness factor change in teachers when their understanding of how to promote learning is deepened. And I think we forget that it's more, and growing up in Texas, and I don't know if this is appropriate, but sort of the spray and pray teacher development model isn't going to work. It has to be a true connection and a lot longer, a lifelong learning experience for teachers versus, oh, what should I do for PD this year or this month? It has to be a deep-seated understanding.
And I had a recent conversation with someone who told me or who suggested that teachers should embody their practice. They should do it outside of the school. And really, if you're going to be a music teacher, live the music. If you're going to be a literacy teacher, a literature teacher, whatever, live that, write, read. And so I wonder how much we value those outside connections to the work that we have, because we are so forced to go through that tick list of, I need to do my 100 hours of PD this year. How can we shift that narrative? Because that is, again, not something that we can be accountable for, at least this, from the state of that, you know, you need to do this course and get your piece of paper to show that you were there. And how do we start to build that culture of embodiment?
You know, I'm going to start by pushing back on embody. Whoa. And maybe push back is not the right word, but I think that we don't stack skills enough in this day and age, in the sense that I need to go somewhere and gain a skill set that I can relate to what I'm doing. But when I start to stack skills, and as a math teacher, if I have, you know, Microsoft systems engineer certification, I'm able to relate math on a much broader contextualized level. And so I have to wonder if we shouldn't, yes, be looking beyond the school building, but also stacking those skills. I have found the best experience is when teachers are embedded into something they've never done before, and it's a consistent piece that they're constantly embodying and deepening that practice, but it's not in one narrow area. There's a phenomenal book called Range, and he looks at the statistics of how to unpack and stack skills and be a generalist in such a focused society. And I think that when we work with teachers, giving them such a broad context of stacking allows them to make better connections to the entry points that students are bringing in, because they have such multiple entry points. So I would almost say we need to broaden that, their understanding and experiences beyond just one area of specialty.
I guess I didn't explain myself tremendously well, because what I hear from you is tremendously on point. To write a novel, okay, you need to have history. To be a historian, you need to understand literature. And even nowadays, you can't be a historian, yes, if you don't understand chemistry. So, I completely see where you're coming from, of mixing it to create a rich experience rather than a tunnel vision.
Well, and I might add to that too, Benjamin. I think that's actually one of the challenges, is that we have siloed the disciplines as much as we have, especially at the secondary level. And so the teacher who comes in, you know, truly embodying, as you were describing, their subject area without that broader understanding of how it connects to other elements, really struggles to make connections between their standards and the standard of the teacher in the next room, right? Or the other teachers of the grade level. And those interdisciplinary experiences that allow students to start to make those connections. I mean, I remember huge aha moments in the course of my education that almost always had to do with the way that my bookworm love of literature connected to society, connected to sciences, connected to mathematics, connected to everything in history. Those were really major awakening moments. So I think, and in a lot of ways, to go back to your original question of professional learning, I would say that teachers need to experience the instructional practices that we hope that they would use. So beyond the spray and pray, we also have that problem of, I'm going to lecture you all day about why participant-driven learning is so important, right? And why you should listen to your students more and talk less. If I'm going to lecture at you all day about why that's important, I'm never going to drive my point home, right? Whereas if the experience that I create for you includes that, I love this term, rewilding, and all sorts of opportunities to think in different ways and to make new connections and to be active actively involved in and at the heart of what we're designing. That's why I don't believe in canned curriculum. I don't think it works. You know, so I think part of it is that we actually have to let go a little bit of our love of our particular subject area, at least at secondary levels. And we have to experience these other ways of learning and being so that we can see the value of it and therefore be not just willing, but excited about what that means to bring it to our kids.
And I love this idea of flexible learning for the adults as well, of having the courage to just dive into something they have no idea about and taking that journey with the younger learners. I just want to conclude here one last question in terms of just looking at your collaboration, where you guys are, the work that you have ahead of you. What are some exciting things that are on your horizons?
Great question. Well, I'll start if that's okay, Jill. We're preparing right now a workshop that we hope to give multiple times. We'll be taking it to a conference in Hawaii shortly, looking at doing some article writing on this topic and potentially writing something a bit bigger that helps teachers, helps leaders to envision this intersection of culture and space. And I think that I think there's a lot of great potential there in terms of where this might go. I'm also working on a different book project that has to do with leaders who are facing resistance against things that they know are right for learners. And I think there's probably a connection between the topics, as always, because I think there are negative perceptions, if you will, not of the fancy new building, but of the flexible learning and that chaos that we were talking about earlier, and a fear that means that there's not learning happening. So I think it certainly fits into that as well. But I think we're really certainly excited to bring some of this new thinking about what learning what spatial ethos might look like, and how we might cultivate it in our schools.
And I'm fortunate enough, I'm in the classroom. I'm doing, right now I have 12 pilot classrooms and Pathfinder projects, where it's really that teacher embedded piece and looking at the connections and taking anywhere from a 4 to a 6 month time period and really embedding teachers in what does it mean for us to be spatially proficient in understanding that this space isn't mine. This is a co-owned, co-created space. And how do we start to reimagine what that looks like through our teaching practice? So I'm really fortunate to be steeped in the actual work with the teachers on a daily basis and collecting that data around what that journey looks like for them based on who they are and what their traditions and cultures are. And so bringing that work into the work with Jennifer and into other avenues as well. So it's really exciting.
I totally forgot to mention that right now I am at the beginning of a process too with Austin Independent School District in Texas around 6 new buildings for 6 schools. There are more schools involved in the current bond, but really excited to bring some of this work to those schools. They are schools that are steeped in culture, that have a really beautiful, diverse student body and teacher population, and are all Title I schools, right? So they're all schools that have been ignored, or they feel that they have been ignored for a long time. It's really exciting to think about what this process will look like as they have these new buildings, as they shift toward a more student-centered culture, but also hold on to who they are and who these students are, and you know, find ways to really bring some of that existing culture into these new spaces with them so that everyone in those buildings thrives.
Well, thank you both. I really appreciate your time and just such wonderful conversations. I feel like there's so many threads that we could keep pulling on. Thanks so much, and this opens up more questions than we have responses to, which is exactly what we want to do on this show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
This has been the Coconut Thinking Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Our website is www.coconut-thinking.com. That's www.coconut-thinking.com. And if we are in partnership with Intrepid Ed, www.intrepidednews.com. Leave us 5 stars, subscribe, tell your friends, and we always look forward to your comments. So please leave them on the site, on our website, or just email us directly through LinkedIn. Until our next episode, talk to you soon. Bye-bye.